Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi is stuck in a donation scandal with Donald Trump that just won't go away.
Of course I ask Donald Trump for a contribution. That's not what this is about. She was saying he was under investigation by my office at the time, and I knew about it, none of which is true.
Also this week, if current projections hold, state budgeters may have to tighten their belts in the coming year. But Republican leaders say the problem is spending, not revenue.
Every single government person comes up here and spends money like a teenager in a mall with a first-time credit card, and they're locked in there.
We'll also hear about a glimmer of hope Congress might finally set aside some money for Florida's Zika response. And we'll find why post-traumatic stress syndrome isn't confined to soldiers fighting on distant battlefields. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi continues to face questions over whether a campaign contribution Donald Trump gave to her in 2013 was in exchange for dropping a potential investigation into his real estate investment program, Trump University. Now, as Lynn Hatter reports, congressional Democrats are calling for an investigation into the issue, and so are newspapers, and the issue is not going away.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump recently paid a fine for a campaign donation made in 2013 to Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. Bondi asked Trump for the donation, and it came from his charitable foundation, a violation of tax law. Democratic Florida Congressman Ted Deutch believes Bondi was considering whether to join a fraud investigation into Trump University at the time.
But before Bondi made a decision about how she was going to proceed, she solicited, and then she accepted $25,000 in campaign contributions from Donald Trump.
But Bondi strongly denied an investigation ever took place when asked about it recently by Fox News host Neil Cavuto. And she placed blame for the narrative on Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton.
No, of course I ask Donald Trump for a contribution. That's not what this is about. She was saying he was under investigation by my office at the time, and I knew about it, none of which is true.
Bondi's office released more than 8,000 pages of documents related to the donation. The New York Times recently reported the Florida Attorney General's office had received nearly 24 complaints before Bondi took office. Only one complaint came afterward. In 2013, around the same time she asked for the donation, an investigation into Trump's real estate program was unfolding in New York. The Orlando Sentinel first wrote about it that same year. But in 2014, Bondi announced her office would not be joining the investigation. And there's no hard evidence one was ever even underway. And that, says Tampa Bay Times reporter Michael Oslin, is part of the issue.
I'm not as scandalized by the fact that this came from the foundation account versus his personal account. I think that the questions worth asking are more in the line of, was he expecting the attorney general to not act, or was he perhaps giving her money in hopes of keeping her in office because she hadn't acted already? I think those are really important questions worth asking.
Bondi attempted to give the donation back to Trump, but it was rejected. And Trump has maintained the money coming out of the charity was a clerical error. Still, he has boasted about buying influence from elected officials before.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking at the ones I'm running against. I've contributed to most of them. Do you believe it? I've contributed to most of them. And one of them said, no, I don't think you've contributed to me. They found out I did. I contribute to every. I've given to Democrats. I've given to Hillary. I've given to everybody because that was my job. I got to give to them because when I want something, I get it. When I call, they kiss my ass. Okay? It's true. They kiss my ass. True. True.
That's from a January campaign rally in Ohio. Yet even if there's no smoking gun in the saga, Bondi's political future is growing increasingly cloudy. She's been rumored as a potential 2018 gubernatorial candidate or even a congressional hopeful. But Politico Florida's Matt Dixon says that's now in doubt.
Trump has faced months of bad headlines, and you know he's used to it at this point. She is not. But in the context, I don't think anyone knows what her political future is anymore. People used to think she was going to run for Congress or had statewide aspirations. She's different aspirations. And I don't know what her next step is. So if you don't really have a next step politically, I don't know if it can politically hurt you. So we'll see. But in a vacuum, I would say she's facing the brunt of this.
Bondi may be caught in it a while longer. There's a growing number of voices, including congressional Democrats and newspaper editorials, calling for investigations into the Trump-Bondi connection and Trump's charity. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida lawmakers will face some tough decisions next year as they draft the state budget. Nick Evans reports leaders are already warning cuts are in store.
About a year ago, state economist Amy Baker warned lawmakers there were only about $75 million available for ongoing projects. If they committed any more than that, the state budget would quickly be in the red. And the picture isn't any better this year.
Looking at everything, you do have enough money available to you to avoid a budget gap in fiscal year 17-18. However, you don't have any money that would be left over to allow you to deal with new discretionary issues.
There actually is some money, but the $7.5 million lawmakers have to work with is vanishingly small in comparison to this year's $82 billion budget. Incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran says the continuing growth of Florida's population will likely drive that figure even higher. New spending needs could easily outstrip the surplus, and Baker says the news is even worse for the next 2 years.
What you see as you look out is a $1.3 billion in Tier 3 shortfall as you move into Year 2, which is 18-19, and it grows to $1.9 billion in Year 3.
Former Senate Budget Chief Lisa Carlton says lawmakers have their work cut out for them. The Republicans served for a decade in the Senate, starting in 1998, and she explains budgeters will have to take a long, hard look at where money is going in order to free up existing funds.
Setting allocations is going to be a very challenging task this year with the revenue shortfall that's projected. Now, what that means is there also will have to be a real evaluation of what items are considered essential in state government.
Items like Medicaid, K-12 education, and public safety are state priorities. But Carlton says empty coffers could put higher education, transportation, and environmental spending at risk. And that could make for a turbulent legislative session. Incoming Senate President Joe Negron has already signaled he wants to establish water storage south of Lake Okeechobee and steer more money into public universities without raising tuition. His House counterpart Richard Corcoran won't rule those projects out, but he says there will have to be cuts.
I think the issue for those is, and the issue for all of us, is if you're going to start spending some additional money, you're going to have to obviously find it in cuts. So yeah, are they on the table? Absolutely. But I think that's going to be incumbent upon the House and the Senate going through and figuring out what other things we're going to cut to make room for those things. And are there things in the budget that are not nearly as essential as the stuff that maybe Senator Negron or House members or Senate members are talking about? Yeah, I think there's a lot of things in the budget that aren't nearly as essential as stuff that's out there that we could be doing.
Republicans have controlled the state legislature for two decades. And when Governor Rick Scott signed this year's budget, he bragged about cutting $1 billion in taxes over 2 years. From one perspective, that's lost revenue that could bolster a flagging balance sheet. But Corcoran doesn't see it that way. He argues Florida has a spending problem, not a revenue problem.
I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. Every single government person comes up here and spends money like a teenager in a mall with a first-time credit card and they're locked in there. It's got to stop. And we got to start cutting up the credit cards.
Corcoran didn't say where in the budget he'll find savings. But Lisa Carlton is optimistic lawmakers will find a way to strike a balance between wants and needs.
When they're are fewer recurring dollars, everybody, legislators sort of buckle down and they really look at the priorities of their district and what are the essential needs of their district and their communities. And so it really makes for a little bit more structured budgeting process when there are fewer recurring dollars.
And she warns, as Corcoran does, the September projection isn't the final word. Lawmakers use another estimate to craft the budget, and things can change between now and then. But the last time that estimate came out, forecasters reduced their outlook by about $400 million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Congress may be inching closer to a funding deal to combat the Zika virus impacting hundreds of Floridians.
But we need a clean solution here to a messy problem. This should be a healthcare problem, a life problem, and not a political problem on Capitol Hill.
It's no surprise that the companies that make and sell electricity aren't really fans of people being able to harvest their own solar energy. But that doesn't mean they're not putting up a good fight to keep the status quo.
I think in some ways they're trying to stay alive. I think that they're up against a very difficult situation. They're being asked to put in place a series of transitions, which in many cases might in fact put them out of business.
And post-traumatic stress syndrome isn't only confined to overseas warriors. Those exposed to battle-like conditions on the home front are vulnerable as well.
I know there's a lot of people that don't believe that PTSD is a real thing, that they think that people should just be able to get over it.
There could finally be some good news for Florida's congressional delegation and Governor Rick Scott when it comes to federal funding to fight the Zika virus. Florida just passed the 800 mark for the number of cases reported to health officials. But as Sasha Cordner reports, Florida leaders are a bit split on how that funding should be accomplished, even if Congress coughs up the cash.
On Monday, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson announced to the Senate that congressional leaders are working on a Zika funding plan.
I think we have finally found a path forward to fund the fight against Zika. The specifics are still being worked out, but it seems that there will be a deal.
That deal will likely be included in a temporary spending bill to fund the government through early December. Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who says he normally wouldn't be on board with that, calls it necessary.
With Zika becoming a public health emergency the way it has, it's worth making an exception for something like that when the Zika funding is in it. At this point, I just really believe that we need to get Zika funding approved and moving.
Rubio has been in talks with Governor Rick Scott, who recently made a two-day trip to Washington, D.C. to speak to House and Senate leadership, as well as members of Florida's congressional delegation. Scott says the time for politics is over.
I'm disappointed that this didn't happen back before the Congress went on recess back in May. I'm also disappointed that Bill Nelson, a senator from Florida, voted against funding last week. He turned the back on Floridians.
Governor Scott met with a slew of Florida Republicans and Democrats. Missing from that list was Senator Nelson. Nelson previously did vote against a House measure that included $1.1 billion for Zika funding, but he says he did it
because political riders were added. Zika doesn't have anything to do with the Confederate flag, and Zika doesn't have anything to do with defunding Planned Parenthood.
Behind the scenes, congressional aides are now saying the defunding Planned Parenthood provision was taken out Thursday by Republican negotiators, which pleases Democrats, bringing Congress one step closer to a Zika deal. Still, some among Florida's congressional delegation say Scott's comments about Nelson may be hindering the Zika conversation. Those feelings come from both Democrats and Republicans. South Florida Congresswoman Ileana Ruslehtonen, for example, has called Nelson helpful and doesn't need to be called out. And Rubio also made similar remarks.
My colleague, Senator Nelson from Florida, has been great to work with on this and multiple issues, but on this one in particular. And I thank him for his partnership and his hard work in this regard. I enjoy our partnership on many issues involving the state of Florida, including the water bill before the Senate, but on this issue of Zika in particular. But it's time for the rest of us to come together in the interest of our people.
And while all agree Zika funding is a must, there is a bipartisan movement in the House asking for a clean bill. Among them is Florida Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, a Democrat.
Let's do this. Let's see if we can get all of the Republicans and Democrats together, because mosquitoes don't have a party. They will bite anyone.
Wilson is the co-sponsor of a Zika bill by Florida Congressman Kurt Clausen, a Republican. It's $1.1 billion for Zika efforts with no additional amendments.
I support my part. We can't spend a billion or two for babies and for pregnant women. I mean, where's our priorities? I'm sorry I'm getting emotional. But this is, to me, this is a big moment in the history of Florida. If I'm being urged to vote to spend big money overseas for bombs, well, by God, I'm going to vote for financial bombs to go after a bad mosquito in order to save babies.
The issue has not only crossed party lines, but it's united some feuding Democrats as well. Florida Congressmen Alan Grayson and Patrick Murphy were engaged in a bitter primary fight. Murphy won and will now face Rubio in November, but that didn't stop both Grayson and Murphy from participating in a bipartisan press conference in Washington, D.C., calling on a clean Zika bill. Murphy says it's urgent.
CDC said that they are essentially running out of money. They have shifted resources from other research for HIV, Ebola, cancer, diabetes, to focus on Zika. But now those resources are exhausted.
As for Grayson, he says the Zika issue has also affected him personally.
I got married recently. We were talking about where to go on honeymoon. I asked my wife what she thought would be the best place to go. And she said somewhere without Zika. All over the world, people are making the same decisions.
Meanwhile, there have been concerns raised about the state's reporting of Zika cases. While health officials have stood by their reporting as accurate, they have now included reports of people outside the state who have contracted the disease from Florida mosquitoes. Close to 90 pregnant Florida women have Zika. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
But earlier today, Governor Scott became impatient with the lack of a congressional commitment and authorized another $10 million in state money to fight Zika. That brings to more than $36 million the total amount of money from the state's general revenue fund so far brought to bear on the problem. In her book, The Grid, McGill University cultural anthropologist Gretchen Bakke points a harsh spotlight on a system that's aging, plagued by outages, and incapable of switching to renewable energy. In a conversation with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash, Bakke says Florida utilities see a massive switch to solar power as an existential threat and for good reason.
I think in some ways they're trying to stay alive. I think that they're up against a very difficult situation, which is that they're being asked to put in place a series of transitions, which in many cases might in fact put them out of business. And so you see in different states this is playing out very, very differently. In Florida, and maybe Arizona, but anyway, somewhere in the Southwest, there's a lot of recalcitrance on the parts of the utilities about they're trying to figure out ways to make money or to keep renewables, especially solar, from permeating the market.
Okay, if we didn't take into consideration their economic incentive, if we only viewed this through an ecological lens, and if we could wave a wand and say, okay, tomorrow we're going to install solar panels over all 20 million homes in Florida, there would be no way to transmit that power, or maybe no need to transmit it, I guess, right?
Right. Well, no, the problem would, in fact, be that that there would be a lot of power being produced during the day, more power than Florida can actually use, and no power being produced at night. And so electricity, given the current grid that we have, it would probably shut down at noontime because it can't deal with excess. We don't have a reliable way to store electricity, so we have to use it when it's made. So it probably shut down at noon because there'd be too much electricity, and it would for sure shut down as soon as the sun starts to go down because there wouldn't be enough electricity. In fact, there would be none if you were at 100% solar. So there has to be, in the transition to renewables, there has to be an accounting for ways to make electricity when there's on a cloudy day, for example, or at night, and ways to try to absorb the electricity that too much solar
And occasionally too much wind, but especially too much solar makes in sunny places during the day. The problem is the 100% dream of renewables is very, very difficult to achieve. But getting to about 80% is an interesting project. So think about, okay, we still have 20% of our power made by fossil fuels. We need that for right now because it's just too hard to figure out how to only make electricity with renewables in terms of the way the grid is structured. It's not too hard to make the electricity, but it's too hard to use it with the system that we have in place.
Do the climate scientists give us enough time to make that transition?
I think the big issue is that we don't want blackouts or tragedy now. And since electricity is immediate and we have the system we have, it's very ripe for no power at all, and no one wants that. So how do we avoid a sort of disastrous scenario in the short term, and let's say over the next 5 years, which is what we'd get if we just said, okay, now we're going to make all of our power in Florida by solar? And also avoid a disastrous scenario over the long term, which is what we get if we don't do anything or if we move too slowly.
The whole reason they're putting Amendment 1 on the ballot is for that subsidy language. They're saying we can't subsidize the solar people's free ride. Are you making that argument? Are you saying there's some truth to that?
If they make electricity in a coal-fired power plant, for example, they get it for... let's say, 6 cents a kilowatt hour, and they sell it for 13 cents a kilowatt hour. But if they buy it from someone who's making solar power, they have to pay that 13 cents per kilowatt hour to the solar power producer. And that just means that the electricity is a lot more expensive for them. And the people who make solar power, people who have home solar systems, they are still on the grid all of the time. So it's not that they're making electricity for themselves. And in fact, if there's a blackout, they black out too. So is there merit to that argument? Yes. If we want to use it, there has to be some sort of money that goes into taking care of it. So the question is, are the investor-owned utilities the best way to do that? And I think the answer is up in the air. And they know that, and that's scary. And they're very highly regulated, which means that in some ways their hands are tied, and influencing how regulation plays out is a big part of their, of their survival.
That's McGill University cultural anthropologist Gretchen Vaki speaking with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash. Florida's unemployment mark has remained unchanged for a fourth consecutive month. That's according to the State Department of Economic Opportunity jobless figures that were released today. They showed an estimated 454,000 Floridians as being qualified for unemployment in August. That was 3,000 fewer than in July. But at the same time, Florida's labor force shrunk by 13,000 during August. That kept the unemployment rate at 4.7%. Governor Rick Scott, who announced the jobs numbers during an appearance at a video production company in Fort Myers, issued a release highlighting the creation of some 22,600 private sector jobs in August. With the latest figures, the state has been below the national rate of 4.9% for 3 consecutive months. Scott's office also sent out a series of releases that showed businesses in the Orlando region have led the state over the past year in the creation of private sector jobs. That's followed by Tampa, Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, Miami, and Pensacola. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting weren't just clubgoers. One Orlando police officer on the hazmat team was recently diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder from cleaning up the crime scene. And now he's fighting to change Florida's workers' compensation laws to recognize the disorder and other mental health conditions triggered in the line of duty. And we should mention this story, which lasts about 4 minutes, may be inappropriate for younger listeners. Florida Public Radio's Abe Abaraya reports.
Jerry Reeland spent 4 hours with the dead inside of Pulse nightclub. He remembers the blood, the smell. The scene was so bad, the 8-member hazmat team wouldn't let any other officers help them remove the bodies. That way fewer people had to witness what they saw. When Reeland came home late the next day, he was quiet. He looked in on his two kids, and then he went to take a shower.
And then proceeded to go to the shower, shut the door, and I heard him just sobbing. And he just kept saying over and over that he was so sorry for them, and it's been like that ever since.
That's Jessica Reelin, Jerry's wife. She says she doesn't recognize the man who came home that day. He would wake up screaming or grab her wrist, thinking he was grabbing one of the victims. He tried to work for 2 weeks, but he couldn't sleep, and he passed out on the job. The hazmat team was more likely to be called out to a meth lab than a scene with multiple casualties. Reelin was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. 3 months later, he's still working to identify the triggers that take him out of the moment and back into Pulse. White sheets used to wrap victims, Sharpie markers used to write on tags.
Another one is, I'm sorry.
Jerry Reelin reaches across the table and holds his wife Jessica's hand while she speaks. The Orlando Police Department did not approve multiple requests to interview Jerry Reelin for this story.
I just really want people to realize, because it's easy for people to judge from their home. I know there's a lot of people that don't believe that PTSD is a real thing, that they think that people should just be able to get over it, but it really is. It's hard, because when you see your loved ones suffering with it, all you want to do is to fix it, to make it better, but you can't.
Jerry Reelin is still not back at work. He's filed a claim under workers' comp for lost wages, but it's a claim his lawyers expect to lose. Under Florida law, if you're disabled because of a mental health diagnosis that was not the result of a physical injury, you're not eligible for lost wages. So his attorney, Paolo Longo, is challenging the constitutionality of that law and is trying to get lawmakers to change it.
These guys, they say, you know what, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. I got to go back to work because I've got to feed my family. So they've got to go back to work. And then you've got first responders out on the streets with, you know, dealing with these kinds of problems. And that's not good for anybody.
John Burton is a Rutgers professor who's been studying workers' comp laws for more than 50 years. He says about half of states will cover some stress and mental health claims, but Florida's one of only 10 states where mental health claims are never eligible.
The limitations on post-traumatic stress disorder under these circumstances seems to me to be unconscionable. Now, it may be unconscionable if it's still legal. We'll find that out later, but it does strike me as being mean-spirited.
Jerry Reelin is getting a paycheck now. Workers' comp is paying two-thirds of his pay because he's developed severe hypertension due to the PTSD, and the Orlando Police Department has relieved him of duty with pay. But that was done on an individual case basis and isn't guaranteed. Orlando Rallone is deputy chief with OPD.
We have not had this type of situation occur before. We understand that, you know, some people have been affected more than others, and we are committed 100% to ensuring that the members of our agency received every available treatment.
The Reelins say they'll be pushing to amend Florida's workers' comp laws during the 2017 session. For Health News Florida, I'm Abe Abaraya in Orlando.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.